So on creation versus evolution, part one. And so we're going to be discussing evolution. Really, we're going to be discussing it the next time we have class. Tonight, I want to talk about something that just basically the relationship between science and faith. That's really what I want to talk about. But if you did read the creation versus evolution, part one, do you have any questions, any comments or concerns, anything in there that you thought might have been interesting? Creation versus evolution, part one. Anybody? Go ahead and turn there because I want to point out something. Creation versus evolution, part one. And look at the 1, 2, 3, the fourth paragraph. All right. Everybody got it? There are two and only two possibilities concerning origins. We're talking about the origin of life. One or the other of them must be true. That is to say, all things either can or cannot be explained in terms of ongoing natural processes in a self-contained universe. If they can, then evolution is true. If they cannot, then they must be explained by a process of creation. Now, just to be a little bit more specific, there are actually at least seven different theories that scientists have come up with to try to explain the origin of life. So there's really not just two. You can kind of categorize it in two. If it's either basically a creator or something else. it's a creator is definitely one of them. And the other one is pretty much, you can all put them under the category of self-creation. Okay? Because evolution stands or falls on the idea of spontaneous generation, which is self-creation. Okay? So, I mean, basically those are two general subcategories. But and I just read that and I thought, well, I know there are several other different ideas. There's this Big Bang idea. There's this lightning bolt idea that this electric shock hit the earth and kind of formed this organism. Then out of that organism came everything else that you see here. They're all very, very far-fetched. But, you know, scientists say the same thing about creation. It's pretty far-fetched. So what these chapters are going to do is just basically analyze the theory of evolution, define what it is, and then talk about how creation is a viable scientific theory for creation. So, which I think is okay, but we just have to be careful in thinking about science in general, because science in the 21st century, well, no, it's been even longer than that, the 20th and the 21st century, when you talk about science, when you say science, it's going to mean something different than what it was originally intended to mean. So what I want to do tonight is talk about the relationship between faith and science, because many Christians have held that they must be separated, that faith and science are two totally different fields of understanding and knowledge, and there's no way that they can be joined together. And so even, you know, good, well-intended Christians say, well, you can have your faith and religion and all that's kind of in one department. Then you have science and other things that, but you can't ever mix them. So, first thing I want to do, are there any questions about the reading? Anything in the reading before we go on from that? All right. Well, let's talk about exactly what science is. What is science? How can you define science? What do you think? What would be an idea of science? Anybody? What do you think? What is the process of science or the scientific method? You ever heard of that scientific method? Anybody? Right? And then there's a series of steps. Right? And then, say it again.
Material, procedure, hypothesis, procedure.
Yep.
Material, conclusion.
Yeah. Basically, all of that's right. It's just different terms for saying the same thing. But it always starts with a hypothesis. Okay. or an idea. Okay, an idea about something. It's usually trying to figure out something. Saying, well, I think it's this. And so, in order to establish your hypothesis into a law, you have to go through a series of steps. And so you begin to test your hypothesis, which will be the procedure. And you test it and you test it. And depending on the test, it could develop into a theory. Okay? And once it goes from a theory, then it goes to another process or more procedures of testing. You have to test it, test it, test it. And then after a series of tests, then it can be, if it's determined by all of these different tests, if it's been tested over and over again, and if it's been approached from every different kind of angle, and the hypothesis cannot be debunked, right? If it never fails in any of the tests, the scientists say, well, this is a law. Okay, this must be a law of science. All right, so that's the scientific method, and science has pretty much always been. I was doing some research on it today and started thinking about, when did science get started? And there is definitely evidence that people have been doing science in that sort of method. In other words, trying to figure out something, testing it, coming up with theories, and then testing that theory, and then coming to some conclusions that are definite, okay, law. That's been going on for a very, very, very long time, since the beginning of recorded history. But there was an explosion. There was an explosion in the realm of science and just the elevation of science to truth when humanity began to say science can be either equal to or it is the only thing that can define truth. And that's when science and faith began to be separated. But all before that, humanity kind of incorporated their faith into their science some way or somehow. Then it slowly began to separate apart. And this revolution happened. And after the scientific revolution, then people began to say, well, faith and religion is in one department, and then science and philosophy is in another department. What should be the Christian perspective of science, though? Think about our theology, more specifically our anthropology. What I mean by that, the doctrine of man. What does the Bible teach about the basic nature of man? Anybody? What is
it?
Say it again.
Created
in God's image. That would be a positive. What does the Bible teach that could be a negative about the nature of man, the basic nature of man?
Sinful,
right? Depraved, fallen, all right? So when you think about the scientific method, theologically, what should be the limits or kind of the our restraint in doing science as humans? Think about the hypothesis, the tests, theories, more tests, and then laws, and you think about the basic nature of man according to the Bible. What could happen in the scientific method? Given the basic nature of man. Because who are doing the tests? Who are coming up with the hypothesis, right? Man, right? So, if you understand human nature to be a certain way, you're naturally going to think about science in a certain way. So that's why I want to talk about our faith in science. Because I don't think that they need to be separated. But I think our theology needs to govern one. But that doesn't mean that science has the ability, well, that if science ever proves something false in the Bible, that we just turn our face to the science and say we don't listen to it. No. But there's just our view of science, how we understand science. Here's my definition, and I don't know if it came from me or not. I might have read it somewhere, but it's a good one. Science is man's attempt to understand God's world. That's kind of what I think about in my mind. And so, when I think about that phrase, man's attempt to understand God's world, immediately because of my anthropology, because of biblical anthropology, if it's man's attempt, then automatically, by definition, it's a possibility we can make mistakes. I mean, just think about the scientific method, right? Coming up with ideas and you begin to test those ideas. Well, what could be the problem of basing our hypothesis on tests and our theories on tests in order to come up with laws? Think about some example in your mind. if you are trying to figure out why something is a way, doing something a certain way, and you have an idea about it, and then you begin to test it, there's still some holes in the scientific process. Can y'all think of any? I've had all day to think about it, so I don't expect you to pop it on top of your head. Okay, so, but just think about it for a second or two. Can you think of anything?
One of the examples that was given to me one time is that if you grow up in the desert, your perception of the temperature of the world is much different than if you've been around the world.
Yeah.
So science is so much about what you're exposed to. So if you grow up in the Sahara, the average temperature of the Earth is 110 degrees.
Yeah.
If you grow up in the North Pole, it may be 20 below zero.
So perception is big, right? And so think if you're doing a test on something, and the only way to take a hypothesis to a theory and a theory to a law is by testing. And so you test and test and test it, but how do you know when you've tested it thoroughly? Because what if there's one test out there that you didn't think of? What if there's one test out there that you never even consider that could just take you back to the proverbial drawing board, right? So even in the scientific method, it's not truth. Okay, science cannot take man to the truth, because science is man's attempt to understand God's world. Because it is man's attempt, and man is finite in its perception, he's finite in his understanding, he's finite in his knowledge, he's finite in his power, and nobody disagrees with that. We have limits, right? I've been studying about black holes of all things. Anybody ever heard of black holes in the universe and alternate universes and all these things? And it just kind of intrigued me. I was like, how could scientists study black holes when they admit that they cannot be seen? And so I began to figure out how they determine there was black holes. And so the very little that I read, they said that they have these massive telescopes that watch these pockets of gas that they can see the gas. And when the gas is orbiting around this something, they can't see what it is, all of a sudden this image will begin to stretch out real thin towards the center of this cycle and then disappear. Okay, and they say, see, there must be something drawing all of this energy, even the light and everything, to a point of singularity to which they call a black hole. But then I got to think, what if it's something else? I mean, there is all kinds of things. What if a fly landed on the telescope, you know? Or something. Now, I'm thinking, there are so many variables that can happen between these thousands of thousands of thousands of miles to get in front of the view of the human eye that could cause that, you know, that sort of refraction of the light. Anyway, so when the scientific method by its nature it has a lot of facts, but the human mind has to fill in a lot of gaps. Okay? Now, all that being said, science is not bad. I think God has created us with the ability to think like this, to be able to observe the world, and this world provoke questions, and we try to understand things. So I'm not the type of Christian that says that we Christians should be anti-science and science is against the Bible. No. But whatever piece of science, whatever evidence there is that science has come up with, I'm always kind of skeptical about it. Not skeptical in the sense that I'm automatically not going to listen to it, but you always, always have to kind of look into it yourself, because there is a book by the name of the History of Scientific Revolutions. I should have wrote this down. And I think his name is Thomas Kuhn. Anyway, the book was written by a man who basically shows how throughout history, science was elevated to such a point where man put all of its chips into science and into one sort of scientific discovery, just to have that discovery just dismantled by some other discovery, right? And people used to think the world was flat, and people used to think that the sun revolved around the earth and all of these sorts of things. And so there are several. In this book, he highlights, forever. There's always been one scientific discovery that just revolutionizes some sort of field and draws people back to the very beginning. They say, okay, well, there's a test that we didn't see, and so we have to start over and try to figure it out again. And his point is that science has a wonderful place in humanity trying to understand things, but science cannot get down to the truth. And another thing he points out, which I think we all need to be very clear on, is that scientists, they kind of function, so says Mr. Kuhn, that there are the older guys, the older scientists that are reputable, that are famous, that write all the articles, that get published in National Geographic and Discovery Channel, all this sort of stuff. They're the go-to guys. And he says when you get to that level as a scientist, the scientific method begins to kind of go out the door. And what becomes most prominent is that you keep your place, that you keep your name at the top. And then he says that in their science is now skewed by their attempt to try to keep their names in the papers. He said, and he chronicles all throughout history that those scientists that make those revolutionary discoveries are the young guys. The scientists that just get out of college that have nothing to lose, that don't have a name, that are constantly testing other people's theories in the name of science to try to figure things out. But he's saying it's the cycle. Then they get big, and they get on the National Geographic, and then a new scientist comes up and discovers something, and they say, "Oh, don't listen to him. He ain't even been in it long enough, And so begins to try to write things to just uphold his theories because he doesn't want anybody to think that he was wrong. And this is true. Science, like anything else, can be commercialized. I don't watch very much television, but when I am watching television, it's usually something like the History Channel, or Discovery Channel, National Geographic, some sort of documentary kind of stuff. And if you do watch those things, just take notice. I'll challenge you. On any sort of documentary film, if you can find one that doesn't have theatrical music in the background, or some sort of reenactment by some, some very handsome actors, okay? If you can find one of those, let me know. I have yet to see a documentary on the Science Channel or any sort of, informational television program that all the information was couched in entertainment. So it's like you're watching a movie. It's really not that much educational. And so that should say something about what they're trying to do. I don't know anybody from the History Channel, National Geographic. I don't know them personally. But I do know, just like in the newspapers and any sort of magazine, they're out really to do one thing. if they don't make money, if they don't make draw people in to watch their television shows or draw people in to buy their magazines, they don't eat. So whatever really is going to sell is what they're going to publish in their magazines or put on the television. That's kind of the nature of the beast of television. So if the television is your main source of information, just be wary, okay? Be wary, because most of the time, I know especially stuff on Christian documentaries or religious stuff, they quote sources and they quote these guys from some of the most liberal universities and seminaries, people that don't even believe in miracles or the Bible. Folks you never even heard of, but they never ask, the folks that actually believe the scriptures. And you just always have to be careful when you're thinking about science, because science is man's attempt to understand God's world. So, evolution was started by a man by the name of Charles Darwin. And Darwin was observing the natural world. He was observing all this beautiful creation, trying to figure out where it all came from. And so he came up with an idea. Now, we're going to talk really more about the details of evolution and how it is really not science later on. But my point is that, and they pointed out in this chapter, that science has elevated evolution to law. Like it's just a fact. For example, turn in that same chapter to, let's see if I can find it here. Mm-hmm. All right. Let's just go to page 2, the importance of the creation evolutionary controversy. The creation evolutionary question is not an insignificant issue that concerns only a few scientists or a few religionists. In one way or another, the issue touches almost every field of study and every part of life. It deals with two opposing worldviews. Therefore, or should be, of interest to everyone. Various states in America have discussed enacting laws that would not allow the teaching of only one theory of origins. Books are being written by evolutionists that attack the creationist view. Books are being written by creationists that attack the evolutionist view. The news media have become involved. National science associations, teachers associations, and political associations have become involved. Both sides acknowledge that the controversy is not likely to go away anytime soon. There was a time when creationists and their arguments largely were ignored by many in the scientific field. But that hardly is the case now. There is good reason why evolutionary scientists have become alarmed enough to consider creation a threat. For example, in 1981, Associated Press NBC polls found that no less than 86% of the people polled wanted creation to be taught alongside evolution in the public schools. In November 28, 1991, the results of an additional Gallup poll were released. According to the pollsters, 47% of the respondents acknowledged belief in a recent creation of man. Only 9% expressed belief in a strictly naturalistic form of evolution. 97 Gallup poll surveyed that 44% of Americans subscribed to a fairly literal reading of Genesis account of creation, while another 39 believed God played at least some part in creating the universe. Only 10% embraced a purely naturalistic evolutionary view. The results of a Gallup poll released in August 99 were practically identical. That's not the part I was wanting us to find. Go down to the next paragraph. Those are just stats saying that things have shifted, but the point I'm trying to make is that it is science. When I hear people use evolution, the term evolution, whether it be in a magazine or some sort of scientific journal or on television, it's just an accepted fact. It's just a fact. Okay, it's even on our children's television movies or movies. Think about who's seen Finding Nemo. Might see Finding Nemo. I've seen it about a million times because I have a million kids. But the Finding Nemo is there's a bluefish called Dory, and there's a clownfish. What's the clownfish's name? Do you remember? It doesn't matter. It's really irrelevant. Anyway, when Dory is... what's his name, Jonathan?
Marlin.
Yes, Marlin, because he's a clownfish, but he's not funny. So when they meet, the first time they meet, Dory runs into Marlin. He bumps into each other, and he says, "I'm looking for my son. Have you seen a boat?" She says, "Yes, I've seen a boat. It's this way." And she takes off running. He's following her. 30 seconds later, she's looking behind him, and she says, "You know, what are you doing? Why are you following me?" And she does this a couple times, and she says, "Well, I suffer from short-term memory loss, all right?" So, and one of the times that they're chasing each other, no, this is another time, matter of fact, that they're racing, and she says, "You can't fight evolution. I was built for speed." Remember that quote? And, I mean, there are just time and time again in our movies, in our sitcoms, and in every sort of scientific show that's talking about the origins or creation or anything like that, it just accepts evolution as fact. But think about the scientific method, and then think about evolution. There is a hypothesis, all right? So in evolution, there's a hypothesis that there must have been a long period of time in which something that was very small and a non-living organism produced everything that we see now through the series of mutations over a long period of time and through the survival of the fittest. Now we have the world as we know it. Question. How would you test that? How would you test that? If this hypothesis is based on something that happened millions and millions, maybe even billions of years ago, that began with some element or some sort of something that no longer exists, how could you ever test the evolutionary hypothesis? You can't. You can't. You can't do it. So that's why it's called the evolutionary theory. But in order to get to a theory, you have to go from a tested hypothesis, right? So why don't they call it the evolutionary hypothesis? That just doesn't roll off the tongue as well, I guess, and it's kind of hard to say. Because in reality, it's still just a hypothesis because it's never been tested. The hypotheses, I guess that's what you'd say, just kind of were allowed to just develop and develop and develop without actually being tested, because you cannot test them. Now, someone could say, well, you can't test creation either, because you can't recreate that. You can't, you know, create an environment in which there's nothing in order to create something. But the thing with creation, though, the fact that we can't test it is almost a case for it. Because since it's a fact that we can never create an environment where there's nothing and produce something, that still leaves us with how the world is. For example, so if I wanted to test, if I was a scientist, want to do the scientific method on, I have a hypothesis that the world was created. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to create an enclosed environment. And I'm going to create in this environment everything that is needed to sustain life. So I'm going to fill it with oxygen and I'll put soil in there. But that's it. Okay? And I want to see human life come out of it. All right, let's just use human life. Because as I was saying, I was thinking, well, I was thinking about the joke. You all heard of the joke about scientists? And they say that, scientists claim they can create too. They've developed a method that can create. And they're talking to God. They said, God, we no longer have to believe that you created the world because we've figured it out. They said, all you have to do is you take this amount of soil and you put it in this beaker and you begin to heat it up. God says, oh, wait a minute. Get your own soul. That's a good point, right? So just for our sake of argument tonight, if I was a scientist and wanted to do the scientific method in creating human life, and I create an environment, an entire universe, and a 3x3 globe, and I put in a massive earth there, and I created the right amount of heat and all of this sort of oxygen, and all of the levels were just right, and there was nothing on this little globe, and I left it there for... Well, I'd only have to leave it there for my lifetime unless I passed on the scientific method to somebody else. But just for giggles, okay, I tested it the rest of my life. Say I spent 50 years watching this globe, this earth with nothing on it. And I kept watching and I kept watching and I'd come back every day and I'd examine it. And I'm testing my hypothesis to see if Earth can produce of its own human species. And so I couldn't do it, so I'd die. The son comes along, he does it for his whole life, his son comes along. And this goes on for ages and ages and ages. Guess what's going to be in this 3x3 cube in this make-believe universe? It's nothing. We can't test it because we can't do it. Nothing can do it. So the point is, since we can't do it, since nothing in the universe can do it, nothing in the natural world can do it, then there only can be one explanation. Now, scientists will say, well, maybe it was a lightning bolt, maybe it was a bang, maybe it was all this other stuff. But then you have to get to the point. There's a belief, actually by some, it's called, it was a weird word. It was panspermism. That's what it's called. Okay? And I think there's another called transformation or something like that. Anyway. The point is that there must have been life forms on other planets when these planets exploded. They entered into Earth's atmosphere aeons and aeons ago, and they survived through the fiery entrance into the Earth's atmosphere, lodged itself in the soil, and then more aeons and more aeons, these, whatever this non-living organism is, produced living organisms, and from those living organisms produced everything we see now. That is one of the viable theories. But then you have to say, well, where did that life source come from? Who created life on that planet? So you're always going to come back to the fact someone or something had to start it off. And so, but then there are this thing called theistic evolutionary theory. Theistic evolutionary theory. You know what that is? Theistic, like theology or theism, that God used the evolutionary theory. God used the evolutionary theory. You ever heard of that? Theistic evolution?
James Dawson.
Does he really?
I think so.
Well, if you study evolution in detail, thinking about science as what we have now, and thinking about the scientific method, it's really more theoretical than anything else. Scientists have to fill in a lot of gaps in order to make it work, but still, as we're going to see in a couple weeks when we talk about evolution in more detail, it still doesn't work. So, evolution, even as a hypothesis, does not pass any tests because it cannot be tested. So it would just seem to go by way of definition, theistic evolution. I don't know. I don't understand how that works either. Now there is this thing called micro and macro evolution. I can't remember which one, what chapter it's in. Do y'all remember reading about that, or is it in the same one? Because what can be observed is species adapting to temperature changes or rainfall or something like that, that certain species adapt to the environments in which they live. But no matter what the case is, scientists have confirmed that like species produces like species. If you put a cows in a pasture, you're only going to get cows. If you throw a horse in there, guess what? You're still only going to get cows. It's not going to happen. We have yet to find some sort of animal that was kind of stuck in between. I was reading an article on Science something. It was some sort of science website, and it claimed to be the missing link of scientific theory, because they found one animal. They found one animal that was mutated. It was mutated. And they say, see, this animal obviously is in the, this mutation stage, and it's going into something else. So if we were to test that, in order to test that hypothesis, if you found some weird animal in the woods, and you say, ha, this could be proof that the evolutionary theory is true, what would you have to do to take your hypothesis to the level of theory, and then from the theory to the law? Would one animal do it?
You have to find the source.
You're going to have to find the source. You're going to have to find more than one, because one animal doesn't seem to sufficiently prove anything. We went to the fair. They have this old exhibit that's been there ever since I was a little kid, and it's got just that one little trailer that this old man has, and you go in, it's got the four-legged turtles and the two-legged or two-headed snakes and all this other weird stuff, But this guy has those as weird exhibits because they're weird exhibits. They're abnormal. They're something that you hardly ever find on the face of the planet. And so when you find an abnormality in the created world, it's natural for us to think this isn't normal because we've never seen anything else like it. Now, if there were, say, four-legged turtles, a bunch of them, and then we saw, four-headed turtles, a bunch of them. There's a bunch of those. And then we saw a bunch of three-headed turtles. Then we found a whole bunch of two-headed turtles. Then you could say, wait a minute. There seems to be a progression in this mutation that it must have started out with four, and now it's developed into one-headed turtle. But there's never been any sort of evidence of any sort of animal, any sort of species, ever. And on top of that, the evolutionary paradigm says this, that the survival of the fittest, that those that are the most fit survive of that species. Guess who they say is at the top of the food chain of the species in the world? Can you think of what animal?
Mankind.
Okay? They say humans are at the very top because they are the most fit. They have survived. They are the ones who, they're always out on top. And but the problem is, like we read, I think, in the last lesson, why are we the only ones worried about where we came from? If we're just a part of the animal kingdom, and we've developed through our aeons, through all of our ancestors, our primates that we came from, why aren't our second cousins in the jungle swinging from vines? Why aren't they up there talking about philosophy and geometry? Why aren't they discussing all of these theological propositions concerning their religion? Monkeys. Right? You would think that sometime in recorded history there would be some historian that says, we went to some village and they were half monkey and half man. Weirdest thing I ever saw in my life. Never, you've never found anything of even the most fit of beings that there's any sort of chance of this evolutionary theory ever to work. It just doesn't fit. It's not actual science. It's not actual science.
If we evolved from monkeys, then why are there still monkeys?
Yeah. If we were the most fit, we should have exterminated that sort of species a long time ago, right? But this other kind of evolution, I get them mixed up. I think it's, is it macroevolution that talks about the adaptations? Somebody know where that is on this page? I didn't. Page, is it on the very first page? All right. Creation includes the evidence for a sudden appearance of complex life. The creation model denies vertical evolution, also called macroevolution, the emergence of complex organisms from simple organisms, and change between kinds, such as amoeba gradually changing into a man, but does not challenge horizontal evolution, also called microevolution, the formation of species or subspecies within created kinds, or genetic variation such as a species of birds gradually getting a smaller beak, or a species of moth changing colors over time. These things can be observed. This is what true science can get to, because we can observe a species of birds or some sort of species of animals in one region of the earth and another region of the earth and try to figure out why are they different. They're obviously the same animal, but why is this one adapted more to this specific region than this specific region? And you can even see this in humans, right? I was in the doctor's office yesterday, and my doctor is from India, okay? What kind of climate is in India? Pretty cold in India. No, it's not cold at all, right? It's very warm all the time. So I walk into the doctor's office. Guess what he had his air conditioner on? Off. So I'm sitting in the waiting room sweating bullets. I'm thinking, what's going on? And it started hitting me. I was like, he's not sweating at all. He's pretty comfortable because he has evolved, okay, into being used to warm climates. And that is the case for even in our culture, in American culture. I have noticed, because I'm in the heating and air conditioning profession, when I go to a person's house, their air conditioner's broke, and if this person's over the age of 70, after I fix their air conditioner, you know what they tell me to set it on when I leave? About 80, 85, you know. So I'll go to the next job, and this person's 30-something. I say, all right, it's fixed now. What would you like me to set your thermostat on? Put it on 65, buddy. 65, you know. And then I get these calls from 30-somethings, and it's 110 degrees outside. And they say, it's 72 degrees in my house, and I'm sweating. And I'm thinking, man, that's pretty good, 72 degrees for 100 degrees outside. But then I've gone to people's houses just for a routine checkup in the middle of summer, and their air conditioner hadn't worked for months. And they never noticed it. And I asked him, I was like, this thing's broke. And I said, well, I didn't even notice it. And it's like, I didn't have air conditioning most of my life. And I said, well, that makes sense. If you were never raised having an air conditioner, you probably not don't like it that cold because you've adapted to a warmer climate, especially here in Texas. So this idea of microevolution, I think it's pretty feasible. We can test that sort of hypothesis that those who are raised in warmer climates are generally going to like it warmer. But this micro, this what he calls a vertical evolution, it just doesn't fit into science. You have to classify it into something else because it just doesn't work. But I want you to take notice on anything that you read in some sort of science magazine, if you watch on television, I don't watch that much, but I have yet to read or hear of somebody talk about evolution as either a theory or let alone a hypothesis. It's just a given. And I was reading a National Geographic magazine about this discovery, and I probably have mentioned this before. The scientist was holding it in the palm of his hand, and it was no bigger than the size of a dime. It looked like a rock. It just looked like a rock to me. But they said this was an amazing discovery because it was an eardrum of a species that has evolved from a sea creature to a land animal. And they even had illustrated pictures of what it looked like, how big it was, and they had each stage of evolutionary process, how it went to a sea creature, then it grew legs, and it started, you know, being a sea and land creature, then it turned into like it was basically like some sort of alligator looking thing. And see, this piece of evidence proves the evolutionary process of this specific species. And I'm just thinking, how do you get from there to there? Exactly. It takes a whole lot of faith to believe it. Because I'm trying to think, if that's all they have, and there might not have been, but I read the entire article. It was all about this eardrum that they found. And I'm trying to figure out how they knew it was an eardrum. And the best that I can gather is that it was shaped like an eardrum in this alligator. It was shaped the same way, but they said this thing's millions of years old. And I'm thinking, how did an eardrum survive in the dirt for millions of years to be such an amazing shape for a person to go, how old an eardrum? I would have picked that thing up and said, it's a rock. It looks like every other rock that's laying around here. But I was trying to figure out, there has to be more evidence. There has to be something more for you to get to point A to all the way to point B way over here. But whether or not there was information, the one thing that is sure in that magazine, the authors, the publishers wanted me, the reader, or better, the consumer, wanted me to read this article and be just blown away by the science. Now, they were probably doing it just to, market it, just to sell a magazine. But what they're doing, either intentionally or not intentionally, is really they're not doing justice to science. They're really doing more harm, and they're creating a public that thinks of science that way. Paul?
Well, and the problem also is with the school. The school system's not even presenting the option of a designer.
Right.
They're just saying evolution, they don't present it as a hypothesis.
Right.
Like you said, it's law.
Right.
There's no room for anything other than that. And if anyone challenges that, you're dumb.
Right, because who would challenge a textbook, right? If it's written in a textbook, my goodness, it's got to be accurate. Well, if you're a Christian, you're thinking about the basic nature of humans, and you're thinking that these are human people writing these things. You've been using human instruments, man-made instruments, human minds with corrupt, fallen human hearts. And we know that a large majority of the scientific community is really trying to make a name for themselves. We know that. Going into reading these textbooks, we would kind of be, a little hesitant to just lock, stock, and barrel believe everything that is said. I'm not against science or anything like that, but when science is done properly, I would have no problem with people espousing evolution if they talk about it like it's science. But they don't. They elevate it to the level of truth, which science cannot get to truth. Okay. Here's one of the other issues, just for the last few minutes I had with this. The problem, and I haven't spent a whole lot of time thinking about this, but it seems to be an issue when we say that creation is a viable scientific option to the explanation of origins. It seems like creation is kind of put on the same level like scientific theory. See, but creation, although it cannot be tested either, so it cannot necessarily, you cannot put your science to it. Our reason, though, our minds, everything else around us, when we talk about, existence of God, from morality, cause and effect, teleology, and things like that, that's not science, right? That's reason. We can look around us and say that there's got to be something that caused all this. So specifically, technically speaking, you can't put creation under science because I don't see how you can test it scientifically. Now, there are tests you can do around nature that you can come to a conclusion. Well, all of these experiences and all of these tests have given me the conclusion that the origin of species must have happened by something outside of creation. Right? Science can tell me that. But we can't get to Christianity from it. That's my point. All science is going to do is tell you what it did not, what did not happen. It takes revelation to explain that God created the world. Okay, and so this is why I'm kind of hesitant to kind of throw creation up there as a scientific theory that can be scientifically tested or proven, because I don't say you can, because we can never create the environment again in which to create. So y'all understand what I'm saying? I don't think we can use the scientific method to prove creation. I think there are other ways that we can, but it's not that we can use science to get us close. But eventually we're going to have to get to a point where there has to be something. But in order to get from something to Creator God of the Bible, that takes revelation. That takes something else. And that's why after we talk about evolution, we're going to start talking about revelation, the Bible. Because after all of this study of apologetics, the critic can still say, yeah, but that still doesn't tell me anything about your God. There could be hundreds of gods. There could be millions of gods. Right? And there are many scientists that kind of come to that conclusion. Just because they despise Christianity so much, they say, well, okay, you're right. All right? But you know what? There's probably so many gods. How do you know you've got the right God? That's a good point. So if you kind of are reasoning through all of these things, you're going to get to a point where it says, okay, there must be a creator, but how do you know it's the creator of the Bible? That's what we're going to get to later on.